Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Geert, and I am your host for today, and I'm very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Rick Strassman. Good evening, Rick. So glad you're here. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Geert. Pleasure to be on the podcast.
Rick currently is an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at the New Mexico School of Medicine, and he graduated back in the day in biological sciences at Stanford and subsequently trained in general psychiatry at the University of California Davis Medical Center in Sacramento. Academically speaking, he published close to 50 peer-reviewed papers and consulted many different governmental and non-governmental entities. And I guess his most well-known publication is the 2001 book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule. But then again, his research encompasses many more topics. And today we will be discussing the recently published book with Ulysses Press called The Psychedelic Handbook. Rick, before we get to the book proper, could you maybe give us a your research was now, well, didn't start out with psychedelics proper. Could you maybe tell us what you started out with?
Well, when I was a kid, I liked making fireworks and bombs. I was really interested in chemistry and bright colors and lights and the smoke and the excitement and the slightly forbidden aspect of the whole thing. I began college as a chemistry major, interested in starting my own line of fireworks. But I was discouraged, people encouraged me instead to go into medicine. In college, I was on the West Coast at the time, late 60s, early 70s, and there was an influx of consciousness changing technologies that was coming into the West, specifically the psychedelic drugs, specifically LSD, and to some extent magic mushrooms, as well as techniques of meditation from the Eastern religions, Hinduism and Buddhism. So I was struck by the overlap in descriptions of phenomenology that occurred between those two states. There were a lot of similarities between descriptions of the psychedelic experience and the meditative experience, depending on the type of meditation you practiced. And that got me thinking that there must be some common biological denominator that was underlying the overlap in phenomenology. For example, there might be a part of the brain which was activated, both by psychedelics and by meditation. And that explained the similarities in the two states. Back then there wasn't that much known about the human pineal gland, and I began my clinical research career looking at the function of melatonin, the primary hormone from the pineal gland. There were some data back then suggesting that melatonin had some psychedelic properties. It might stimulate dreams. It might make people with depression psychotic. You might have some of its own psychedelic properties. So we studied melatonin quite carefully. This was in the early, it was in the mid-1980s. And as it turned out, which everybody knows now, melatonin was primarily sedating. In the meantime, though, I learned about DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which is a psychedelic compound, and it's made in the human body and had been studied previously in humans. So I switched up, I switched my focus and started working on the DMT study. It was a fairly straightforward psychopharmacology pharmacology study. It was the first new American clinical research with these drugs in 20 years. So the study had to be quite above board, very traditional, nothing exotic. But at the same time, I was interested in whether giving DMT in and of itself without a lot of preparation and coaching and expectancy other than just describe the experience, would there be similarities between the effects of DMT when I administered it to my volunteers and non-drug states with psychedelic properties like dreams, near-death experiences, even psychosis. So, we studied DMT for 5 years. We had approval from the DEA and the FDA, which, regulated that kind of work at, the federal level. I got funding from the National Institutes of Health. Yeah, and I concluded after 5 years of giving a lot of DMT, to a lot of people, that DMT was a psychedelic. It was a mind manifesting or a mind disclosing compound. It wasn't a psychotomimetic. It wasn't entheogenic. It wasn't mysticomimetic. It basically just amplified and clarified what was already in the person's mind, more or less conscious. So that was a major question that I brought to bear in the research, in addition to the basic pharmacology. What are the biological responses to DMT? We developed a new questionnaire to quantify the subjective effects. We published, it helped open the door, opened the door, to the resurgence in clinical research with these compounds in the U.S.
And where did you move your research afterwards? Because it was concluded in 1995, I believe.
I completed my studies. I'm in 1995. We began in 1990. Well, there are a couple reasons. I guess, fundamentally, I had found out what I was most interested in. Secondarily, more altruistic and more career-oriented reason was that I was hoping to be able to accumulate a team to start moving out of the purely psychopharmacology and into more psychotherapeutic applications, even spiritual ones, creativity, those kinds of things, new compounds, structure, activity relationships, like if you add a methyl group or take away a hydroxy group, what's the impact on the subjective experience. But our work was so far ahead of its time that nobody was able to, willing to, interested in, or understood the importance of coming out to Albuquerque, which is admittedly slightly off the beaten track, but still it was the only place in the country that was studying psychedelics, the only place in the world that was giving DMT. But for whatever reasons, I wasn't able, to gather a more multidisciplinary team, to continue the work in less strict, pharmacological, kind of context. Some of my studies were, blocking receptors, augmenting receptors, putting people in brain scanners, and that just wasn't that appealing to either me or the volunteers. So I figured I had, done, my work, and, let's see if the rest of the world would catch up at some point.
Yeah, it's intriguing to see indeed in the documentary, for example, that the subjective experience is pretty much all that matters to the volunteers.
Well, it's the subjective experience, and it's also the reality of the subjective experience. At first, I approached the stories through an interpretive lens. This is Freudian, or this is Jungian, or it's Buddhist, or it's biological, or psychological, or it's archetypes, or things like that. But I quickly found out that, these were the most intense and the most meaningful and the most realistic, the realest things that, people had ever experienced. It was more real than real. And for me to interpret or to view them as, something else, like unconscious conflicts coming to the fore, just, didn't fly. And, I needed to do a thought experiment, accepting the stories at face value, which then opened up channels of communication, and also allowed me to learn more about the terrain. If these experiences are, if they are real, it was an experiment to think that way. Where would that lead? What kind of questions could you then ask? Where is it located? What's the function? What can you get out of it? Those kinds of things.
So when it you touch on many of these topics in the current book, I was curious. So it's really a very nuanced handbook. Let me frame it broadly. Why did that is the book, the psychedelic handbook, indeed, wonderfully colored. Was there a gap, in your opinion, in the literature?
Well, I think that there was. Over the last maybe 5-10 years, there's been quite an explosion of interest in psychedelic drugs. And the people that have been acting as the spokesmen or spokespeople aren't especially sophisticated in their approach. Michael Pollan's book specifically, How to Change Your Mind. I mean, even the title is naive, because you don't change your mind on psychedelics. You clarify your thinking and you become aware of the various things in your mind that you're dealing with. If you want to change your mind, you can be more convinced of the truth of one particular set of options. But if you're a hardcore atheist, and I mean, you're going to be a hardcore atheist on LSD. So it just didn't seem as if a nuanced approach was being promulgated out there, and combined with the push to commercialize psychedelics and psychedelic treatments, they were certainly going to glorify potential benefits and also minimize adverse effects. And even within the research community, I think the whole story isn't really being told as far as adverse effects and what the reigning theoretical models are. Which are basically not spoken about. They're just assumed and built into the design of studies and questionnaires. So, seemed to me important to enlarge the to enlarge the discussion, from an expert, without any, stake in the game, so to speak. I mean, I don't have any grants. I don't, own any shares in companies. I don't have any permits anymore. I'm not doing studies anymore. But still, I've kept up on the, the studies, the research literature. I've been collaborating with other researchers, peer reviewing articles for consideration of publication in scientific journals, lecturing, mentoring students. Slightly, from the outside, so I can, critique what is the mainstream that's developing. If things were, going to be, presented in a balanced, manner, I don't think I would have written the book in the first place, but I, feel some responsibility to the field because, my works, basically, began it in the U.S. and I helped other, groups in the U.S. get off the ground, including, the Hopkins group, so I was beginning to, feel, that the field was, kind of losing its, bearings, it was time for a mid-course correction, as it were.
Yeah. So you you related to this. You have a very specific view of what psychedelics are, what these compounds are, and well, as you already said, there are many different terms for this group of compounds. Why is the term psychedelic so all-encompassing?
I think because it's the most generic. It isn't really dependent on a specific belief in what the state is that psychedelics provide entry into. Common term in the lay press is entheogen, which means generating God from within, which is a pretty freighted term. I mean, it assumes a belief in God, the divine. It assumes that God exists within you, and that a drug can generate it. So that's a lot of that's a lot to swallow. One of the older, terms was hallucinogen, but that is, in a way a bit pejorative, and it isn't accurate because, perceptual effects, although they're quite common, aren't invariant, and are, the perceptual, and are the perceptual effects, hallucinations. That's kind of, pejorative. You usually think of, mental illness when you think about hallucinations. Closely related term was psychotomimetic, suggesting that these compounds mimic psychosis. So I think, psychedelic means mind manifesting or mind disclosing. It casts a very broad net. It, Stanislav Grof is a Czech psychiatrist who's, done a lot of research with LSD and other psychedelics. And he was, quoted as, saying that, psychedelics are non-specific amplifiers of the unconscious. But I think they're non-specific amplifiers of both the conscious and the subconscious and the unconscious. They, basically, work on one's mind, what's already there. It isn't, like they, put anything new into your mind, which wasn't there in the first place. But the connections, can become, more, closely related to each other. You can remember things. You can make associations. You can, feel feelings. But they're all yours. They're not imposed, you know, from the outside in any way. So the compounds are non-specific. Intrinsically, you know, they're specific to you. That you know, the drugs have to work on something, and they're you know, working on your psyche, your mind, your soul, your spirit, your unconscious, and you know, various parts of your mind. So I think it's the broadest base. Psychedelic, could encompass a psychotic state, a mystical state, a religious state, creative. Creativity enhancement, any number of things. I don't think you're limited by any kind of constraining theoretical framework.
So the drugs that you, or the compounds that you group under psychedelics in this volume, they are, well, the classical psychedelics. Well, I won't list them all, but it's mescaline and LSD and psychedelic mushrooms. And then three other compounds, MDMA, ketamine, and selvanorin. What makes these compounds so specific? Why did you include these and not others?
Well, these compounds generally produce similar subjective effects, even if they're pharmacology, may differ among them. The classical or the classic compounds are psilocybin, LSD, DMT, and mescaline. They're all pharmacologically active in the same way. They stimulate what's called serotonin 2A receptors, and those are responsible for the subjective effects. Ketamine is a completely different compound, works completely differently, and it was originally developed as general anesthetic, but if you give smaller doses, it is also quite psychedelic. There's visions and there's voices and there's extreme emotions and those kinds of things. I included MDMA, because it's quite popular, and it's often, lumped together, with other psychedelics, even though it isn't quite, and the pharmacology is different, but also, the subjective effects are different too. The perceptual effects aren't as great. The psychedelic effects, the mind's manifesting effects aren't as great. Mostly is a stimulator or an enhancer of emotions. For that reason, it's quite helpful in, helping people, deal with, post-traumatic stress disorder. But the pharmacology is different. The subjective effects are different, than the typical compounds. Salvinorin is from a mint, a Mexican mint, and it's quite psychedelic, but it's kind of an obscure compound. Not many people know about it, and the consensus is it isn't very pleasant, but still, I've tried it. It's very psychedelic in its own kind of macabre way, and I thought it would be worthwhile to include. There's ibogaine as well, which is an extremely complicated compound. It's more of a classical psychedelic than anything else, so I do include it in the list of classical compounds. Well, there's also 5-methoxy-DMT, which comes from the desert toad, the Sonoran desert toad, which is a classical compound as well. If you smoke enough strong cannabis, that could be quite psychedelic. And I was, thinking about including cannabis in the book, but that would have, taken us a bit, far afield. The chemistry is different. The pharmacology, just the whole, it's a whole story unto itself. I refer to that you can get a psychedelic experience if you smoke enough strong cannabis, but I don't discuss it in any detail.
No, it makes sense. I mean, you give a lot of the both pop cultural and academic history of all these compounds, and if you go into would go into cannabis, that would be another tome such as this. So two of the chapters, one is about the brain. It's a bit more technical, but I think it's a great account on how these compounds work on your brain and on your body. But you also have a chapter on how psychedelics work about the mind, and you give several models on how to interpret the workings of these compounds. I would say, is there any of these models that that you prefer or that you found out worked the best after your research period in early 90s?
The psychological models, that I brought to bear on the study back then were, ones with which I had a lot of familiarity and experience with. Those were the models of Freudian psychology, the unconscious, the preconscious, and the conscious, the id, ego, and superego. It was useful to employ that model, within the setting of the experimental studies themselves, the relationship between me and the volunteers. The relationship is quite intensified when people are, that intoxicated on a psychedelic. And I had been going through my own Freudian psychoanalysis at the time, so I was gaining some familiarity and comfort with working with people, myself as well, in those kinds of regressed relationships. So I utilized the Freudian model, and I described that in the book. And I also brought to bear a number of years of study of Buddhist psychology. I had started Zen. I'm a Zen Buddhist practice 1974, 15 years before, 16 years before, I was learning about meditation, about the Buddhist of perspective on the mind. And also, one summer as an elective in medical school, I studied with a Tibetan Lama in Berkeley who taught us about Buddhist psychology, the Abhidharma psychology system. The Buddhist approach was, was useful on a couple of levels. One was the, the means or, the way, that we supervise, the drug sessions. We would get into a, light state of meditation. Being, kind of hands off, but still, quite alert at the same time, like a combination of activity and passivity. And we wanted the volunteers to have their own trip. We didn't want, to impose anything on them, but at, the same time, we wanted to be there for them if they needed any help. So entering into a light state of meditation was quite helpful there. In addition, principles of Buddhist psychology were instrumental in my developing the questionnaire that we use to quantify the DMT effect. Buddhism divides ongoing mental experience into five separate categories, which are related to each other, interact with each other. To give the the impression of ongoing mental experience, physical sensations, perceptual content, emotions, cognition, and volition, habitual tendencies, we developed a questionnaire which tapped into each of those categories. They're called the skandhas. you know, we could score the degree of somatic effects, the degree of emotional effects, and so on, using that rating scale. And it's actually, been a, like an enduring, legacy of that study, even though, that questionnaire hasn't really been, worked on for almost, 30 years now. It still is, being used in the literature, to quantify, the qualitative effects of, various, compounds. I also, toward the end of that, chapter, or I'm not sure if it's, like the end of that, chapter or its own freestanding chapter, but I since, my original work, I've, delved into medieval metaphysics of the Jewish philosophers. Yeah, it's in that same chapter. I, bring in Aristotle's division of the mind into imaginative and intellectual, faculties, and, how psychedelics, mostly stimulate the imagination. And it's up to us, to stimulate and to, grow our intellect to be able to understand what the, visions and, the voices, mean, what their message is, how to utilize them and extract valuable information from them.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, yes, by all means. Yeah, it did. It illustrates that, I guess that none of the models is exhaustive when it comes to psychedelic experience.
No, and, depending on your approach, you can, basically, find anything in the, psychedelic state, to support your model. If you believe that these, drugs work miraculously, there's a point of view, that if you experience a mystical state, everything else will, fall into place. You'll be healed. So that's kind of a theological model, revelation equals salvation. There's another approach that uses motivational interviewing and cognitive behavioral therapy ideas, and you can find support for the utility of that model as well, therapeutically and theoretically. Carl Rogers, on your client, centered therapy, you just repeat back, to the person, what, they just, told you, and, that moves the process forward. Logotherapy by Viktor Frankl, searching for meaning within your life, within the psychedelic state, is also valid. So I just, chose the ones that I was most comfortable with, it's up to, to the reader to, to explore other ones if they're, so inclined.
Yeah, so a lot of the book is science, but you also go into some practicalities, I would say. Maybe before we go into that, where do your hopes lie currently for the more therapeutic use of these compounds?
I think that psychedelics are super placebos. I think they basically will do anything you want them to do in the right set of circumstances. If you keep an eye on the literature, like every week, there's a new thing that psychedelics do. They'll give you more metaphysical beliefs. They'll help your marriage. They'll make you more in tune to nature. They'll keep you out of prison. You'll have better cardiovascular health. You'll be more progressive. You'll be more open. Help your meditation, help your OCD, help your drug or alcohol or tobacco abuse, help your depression, help your PTSD. They're panaceas.
Your problems.
They're panaceas. They heal all. You have to step back a bit and, wonder, well, how could any drug do that? How could a drug be a panacea? and panacea, ties into placebo. Placebo effects are real. They're biological. You could look at brain under placebo, and there are changes in brain electrical activity and chemical activity under placebo. So I think that it's going to be important to accept the mechanism of action of how psychedelics work. It isn't that they're distinctly antidepressants or distinctly anti-anxiety agents. They're much more than that. They basically will make it more likely that whatever outcome that you're hoping for will occur. And I think that's the reason that that we're seeing this like an avalanche of positive findings. Placebo can also be nocebo. It could be negative effects of bias, expectation, suggestibility, hypnotizability. I think to promote the idea that psychedelics are only good and can be used only for good and their effects are only good is only one half of the story. Case in point I like to raise, probably ad nauseum, is the case of Charles Manson and the way that he used LSD to convince his followers to believe in these crazy ideas, which were extremely violent, antisocial, completely macabre. So depending who's giving the psychedelics to who and for what reason, the outcome can be 180 degrees separated from each other. Therapeutically, I think they're great drugs. They seem to be demonstrating a huge amount of promise. And for wellness, they seem to be extremely promising. They help your meditation, your creativity. There's mushroom retreats in Jamaica now, ayahuasca retreats everywhere. People work through stuff. You need to educate yourself. You need to prepare yourself. You want to make certain that you've got a supportive context within which to integrate the experiences, which can be quite shattering if you're not fully prepared, and you need some backup. You need help to understand what just happened to make the most of your experiences. So as you mentioned, I do discuss the practical. The practical aspects of taking a psychedelic, and in fact the biggest of the chapters in the book is called How to Trip, and it's all about preparation, long term, short term, what drug, what dose, safety measures,
May I give a brief citation from the last minute plan section of the How to Trip? You suggest to quote, make certain to take care of as many loose ends as possible before your trip. Tell those to whom you're close about your decision and ask for their advice and support. To the extent possible, clear the air between you and anyone with whom you may be in conflict. And do not forget about paperwork that you would rather not have to think about. While updating your will seems morbid, it may relieve some of your anxiety when you lose awareness of your body and wonder if you have died.
Right.
Love this.
You have to be very basic. You have to really tend to your garden before you go out there.
Yeah, I guess it's a great guide to those who aim for such a journey.
Yeah, you know, there's a movement in the States and everywhere else, I would imagine, you know, to increase accessibility, you know, to psychedelics. It's, you know, starting with mushrooms, but it's kind of, you know, branching out to ayahuasca and, you know, ibogaine and MDMA and all those, you know, like, you know, decriminalize nature, you know, legalize and, you know, decriminalize, you know, psychedelics. And, you know, most of these movements are, you know, more or less ignoring adverse effects. And I think as there's an increased accessibility and, like, you know, for example, in the state of Oregon, they, you know, passed a, you know, legalization of psilocybin bill a couple of years ago, and they're working out, you know, the details of the state, you know, licensing requirements. And, you know, if you want to be a you know, certified, you know, psilocybin facilitator, you need at least a high school diploma. You know, so that's not really all that reassuring to me that people giving, you know, psilocybin are going to know what they're doing. You know, so there's going to be adverse effects. You know, there's going to be, you know, bad actors, you know, giving psychedelics. There's going to be, you know, people that aren't, you know, suitable for taking psychedelics, you know, taking them. And, you know, there are going to be increased emergency room visits and, you know, hospitalizations, you know, suicide attempts and successes and, you know, psychotic breaks and whatnot. So I think, you know, education is key, both, you know, people giving the drugs and, you know, people taking them. You know, we don't, you know, want, you know, the media to start, you know, saying when casualties or adverse effects begin accumulating, you know, why didn't you tell us about these things? I think we really want them to be front and center as they're, as, you know, these compounds are made more accessible.
I always find it fascinating when going to a party or a festival. I live in the Netherlands. We have quite a history with the use of MDMA. And you see that over the years, a kind of user culture has emerged to such a degree that at least some basic rules are almost always accepted, such as hydrate, but also don't overdo it. Similarly, people, when discussing the use of these compounds, it's often read that overuse, like using more than every couple of months, has very, very bad effects on, well, all different kinds. There's like this popular wisdom emerging also of these adverse effects indeed, but I guess that's in some places where the use is not that present in the culture, that might be more dangerous perhaps in places in the US. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, you know, that you know, there has been accumulated wisdom, you know, since the 60s on it, like, you know, smaller doses, be more careful with, you know, the identity and purity of the drug. In, you know, the case of MDMA, you know, limit your use, you know, stay hydrated, those kinds of things. Those kinds of discussions aren't quite as, you know, aren't, you know, quite as out in the open in the U.S. You know, there's still, you know, kind of a, you know, taboo, even with the increasing popularity in the media. You know, so I think, you know, you know, that there is an underground, you know, culture which has accumulated a lot of, you know, practical wisdom, which I think will, you know, probably militate against a, you know, tsunami of adverse effects. But I still think there are going to be some waves, especially early on.
What about microdosing? How do you feel about that?
You know, I have mixed, you know, feelings about, you know, microdosing. You know, the data are just very slim. You know, the laboratory data are very slim. There's only one study giving more than one microdose in, you know, volunteers. That was the University of Chicago. You know, they gave four, you know, low doses of LSD over the space of a month or two. The claims of, you know, microdosers are really not, you know, substantiated scientifically, but at the same time, you know, there's a growing recognition that, you know, microdosing in people that expect benefit from microdosing is beneficial. So I think it has to do with, you know, the placebo effect. You can give a low dose of a psychedelic, which I think will enhance the placebo response, you know, without a full psychedelic effect. And, you know, that, you know, suggestion or, you know, that idea is borne out by animal data, suggesting that, you know, low doses of psychedelics in lower animals, which do not, you know, produce behavioral effects, typical of a, you know, full dose of a psychedelic, still promote the growth of new neurons and promote the complexity of connections among neurons. And, you know, that may be, you know, part of how psychedelics work. And it, you may underlie the kind of generic, you know, placebo activation by, you know, by psychedelics. You know, so it, you know, could be that, you know, very small, very small doses of psychedelics still promote the placebo response without, you know, subjective effects, without acute subjective effects. You know, so the expectancy can then steer the new neuron growth, the new complexity of, you know, connections in the desired direction, which, you know, could be more creativity, a better mood, those kinds of issues.
Well, we've been over much of the material already that's in the book. I would like to ask one or two more questions. So if you could design a new direction of study or a new direction of experiment, even if just vaguely, what would you aim for? Or are there any specific experiments currently done that you're particularly enthusiastic about?
I think it's important to understand the mechanisms of action. For example, if it is that the placebo response, which is the underlying, you know, phenomenon in the, you know, panacea-like effects of psychedelics that we've been seeing, you can design studies. And I've been encouraging, junior scientists all around the world to do these studies. They're quite simple, but I think everybody's wedded to their own, you know, theory, you know, like it's the mystical state or it's, you know, cognitive, or it's the, you know, default mode, network, or it's ego dissolution, or it's insight or emotional breakthrough, you know. But I think if you could, kind of go one step, you know, deeper, I think if you, you know, looked at, you know, pre-existing suggestibility in research, subjects, and if, you know, there was a, you know, correlation between outcome and, you know, baseline suggestibility or hypnotizability, you know, that would support the idea that, you know, psychedelics enhance suggestibility, enhance the placebo response. And if you're not suggestible or you're not placebo responsive, you would not respond as well as, you know, those who are. You know, that would also, you know, point to studies in placebo responsive conditions as opposed to non-placebo responsive conditions. You know, so for example, you know, cancer is not placebo responsive. You know, so you would think if you were, you know, doing, you know, psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, you know, hoping for an immunological, you know, boost in your treatment for cancer, that it wouldn't really pan out that well, as opposed to conditions which are quite placebo responsive, you know, like allergies, autoimmune diseases, inflammatory diseases. You know, we're already seeing, you know, that, you know, the psychedelics are quite effective in, you know, the treatment of depression. And depression is extremely, placebo responsive. So that's, consistent, with the idea that, that psychedelics are, magnifying, amplifying, the placebo response, because in a placebo responsive, condition, they're quite effective. So those are a couple of, simple research, questions, which I think could be done without, much difficulty. So I think if we understand the mechanisms of action, it'll, keep us, from becoming zealots and, fundamentalists, that, we believe that, this is the way they work, and it's just a matter of using them, for whatever, condition is troubling mankind. I think you ought to, or, one ought to maintain, scientific rigor and, keep on asking questions about, how do these drugs work and what's the best way to use them.
And finally, so you've written several books over the, also over the last 2 decades. Is there anything we can look forward to after this, after the current tome?
Well, I'm not sure if I would call it a tome. It's only 203 pages.
Agreed. It's light reading. Very pleasant indeed.
Yeah. It's quite dense, so I suppose if I unpacked it, it would be, 400 words, but you have to kind of, unpack the material. I wrote the DMT book, back in 2001, DMT, the Spirit Molecule, which is the, the story of the DMT research. It was a great story and it had to be told, so, that's what, motivated, my writing that book. I co-authored a book called Inner Path to Outer Space, which emphasizes the, kind of the alien aspect of the, psychedelic experience. I went back to the, drawing board spiritually, with my 2014 book called, DMT and the Soul of Prophecy, taking it out of the Eastern religious perspective and, moving it into the Western biblical tradition. A few years ago, I got quite sick, super sick, pneumonia, C. diff, like a super diarrhea, super bug thing. And I was really manhandled at the local hospital here. And I swore if I lived, I would write about it. So I lightly disguised the story in an autobiographical fiction book called Joseph Levy Escapes Death, which is, rather mordant, but, pretty funny too. It's like, black, medical humor. That came out in 2019. This book came out last month. I've got 2 big writing projects that I am working on at this point, or once the interviewing schedule starts to quiet down. I've been collecting stories of my own experiences over the last 30-40 years with drugs and with meditation and depression and psychoanalysis and those kinds of things. So I've got a couple hundred pages of interesting stories. They're fun stories. And I've got my own approach to altered states of consciousciness, which I kind of intersperse within the narrative. So it's tentatively entitled Altered States. So I'm going to be working on that. I'm really quite keen on the Hebrew Bible. I've been really carefully studying it for a long time now, and I've been working on my own translation and commentary on the book of Genesis. And I'm almost, finished with the first draft. It's 1,200 pages right now. So I'm not sure if anybody's ever going to want to publish that or even read it, but still, it's one of those things I would like to finish before I die.
Thanks a lot for sharing this, and the talk has been wonderful. So, thank you for being present on the show, Rick, and we hope to talk to you next time, perhaps about altered states.
Great. Well, thanks for having me.